Awesome. Oh, weird. Okay.
Yeah, if you're a Wizard of Oz or something.
Yeah. Can I change the volume on this? It's kind of creepy. All right. Okay. Yeah.
That'll be even creepier.
Okay, so we started talking about GR last week. I wanted to just finish that and then sort of maybe give some ideas about what lessons we could learn from the particle models. So just review a little bit of what we did last week. Like I said, it's very similar to the setting of the particle models. The only difference is that now we have our configuration variables are functions of a three-dimensional manifold instead of just being labeled by a parameter lambda. So this is what I call Barber-Bertoddy geometro dynamics. And the reason is because geometro dynamics is just 3 plus 1 GR. You can basically, the reason why I call it Barber-Bertoddy is because you derive it from this best matching. It's not even, I mean, it's equivalent to standard formulations of 3 plus 1, of geometric dynamics. But it's the, I would say that the motivate like the starting principle is very different, and even the fields that you use are slightly different. But because you get this auxiliary field, which is a derivative, and you take a free endpoint variation of that. Whereas in the normal thing, you have the lapse, which is a Lagrange multiplier, but you do a fixed endpoint variation, and it turns out that those two variations are equivalent. But like I said, a very different starting point. So,
they're equivalent in classic theory, equivalent in quantum mechanics.
It's a good question. I think they are, but because when you quantize the theory, you get the same constraints, you get the same you get the same constraints. So you have the same Poisson brackets and everything. So the quantum theory, as far as I can tell, looks identical as well. But the interesting thing is you might be able to do more with the insight you gain from this approach, and that's something that I might talk about at the end. So the setup is we have an absolute configuration space. So this is sort of the big configuration space with the redundant variables, and these variables are the three-dimensional metric, which is a function of space. This configuration space is called a ream. It's just the set of all possible three metrics. But of course, if you take any three metric, you can apply arbitrary diffeomorphisms to that metric, and you can get equivalent geometry. So all of these are physically equivalent metrics that are just related by diffeomorphisms. So the in the particle models, oh hi Matt, hi Rob. The particle models, the gauge group was the Euclidean group, and moving along, it was doing a rotation or translation of the positions of the particles. Now, moving along the equivalence classes, you just have diffeomorphisms of the three metrics, so coordinate transformations, and this thing is supposed to project down to a relational configuration space, which we don't really know how to parameterize. So we don't know exactly how to parameterize it, but what we do know is that all the points of a particular equivalence class will project onto the same point in here. So it's the same situation that we had before. The gauge group is generated by G, the metric, going to a large diffeomorphism, so the exponential of the Lie derivative, of some vector field of G. So this is the auxiliary field. It's a vector field. How do you write? Sorry. And it has a value at every point x. So it's a field that lives on a three-dimensional manifold, sigma. Okay. Right. Now. Okay. So this type of symmetry will. Again, we have the same sort of fiber bundle structure that we had in the particle models. And because of that fiber bundle structure, we essentially get a covariant derivative defined, or we get a connection defined on this configuration space. And that, effectively what that does is it sends derivatives with respect to lambda to derivatives with respect to lambda plus this connection, which now is the Lie derivative of the, in the direction of the lambda derivative of this vector field. Okay. So that's the prescription. And in particular, when you take the derivative of the metric, the Lie derivative takes a special form. So it looks like it goes to the normal derivative plus the sort of anti-symmetrized derivative of this guy. So the semicolon is supposed to represent covariant differentiation. So it's the covariant derivative of this guy in the direction B, and then you do the symmetrized version of that. Okay. So so this is the special form that the covariant derivative takes, and that's because we've assumed that the covariant derivative of the metric is equal to zero. So normally there would be an extra piece here, but because the covariant derivative of the metric is zero, we don't have that extra piece. Because it goes back to a bit of a long story with the particle models that when you had the covariant derivative, it was always the dot like this with this guy. And the reason is because what you kind of want to do is you want to take the derivative of GQ and then multiply it by G inverse. So when you take the derivative of this thing, it brings down and you get that structure. Okay. So that was the prescription. Now we can write down an action. And the action is just going to be a Jacobi action with this substitution. All right. So it'll look like, so I call it the BB geometrodynamics action, which is an integral over lambda, then an integral over space. There is a factor of root g. Then there is a potential term and a kinetic energy. This is just the standard Jacobi action, but what we've done is we made the square root sort of local, and so we talked about whether or not that was a natural thing to do. So I think it is. I think it's a fairly natural thing to do, even though what they originally did was put the square root over the whole thing. So then the only thing now is to figure out what is a natural potential to use for such a theory and what a natural kinetic energy should be for a theory defined on this type of configuration space. So we're looking for potentials that are invariant under the particular symmetry, which means that we're looking for scalars, scalar quantities that we can form out of the metric. But we're allowed to use the spatial derivatives of the metric because we're not allowed to use the dots, right? Because the dots are going to be in the kinetic term. But we're still allowed to use the spatial derivatives of the metric. So the simplest sort of non-trivial thing that you can think of is the 3 curvature. That's going to be a function of the metric and its derivatives. And then just a constant. So it's, I think, people usually put a factor of 2. So this is, you know, the cosmological constant. And remember that in the particle models, the constant piece of the potential was interpreted as the energy. So in this case, the role played by the cosmological constant is very similar to the role played by the energy. The only difference is that now, instead of the time being a globally defined thing, the time is a local thing. So the connection is not as clean as it was in the particle model between time and energy, between time and the cosmological constant. But there certainly is some interesting connection between the two. So hopefully, I mean, once I go through this, I think it'd be interesting to talk about what one can do. Now, also the link, I mean, one thing in the particle model is we're looking for a principle that says that the energy is zero. And I think that having a principle, having a good reason to believe that the energy should be zero is very useful in the context of these, the geometric dynamics, because then you'd have a reason to say that the cosmological constant should be zero, which would be really nice. I think the cosmologists would probably like that.
The cosmologists suggest that it's small but not zero.
By talking to the cosmologists, they feel like having any type of reason to believe that it could be zero would be good, and then trying to explain the acceleration is sort of a minor thing after. I mean, because it's such a big problem that any progress is good. So yeah, of course, you still have to explain the expansion or the increasing acceleration of the universe that we observe. But you know, maybe there's some other mechanism for that, Now the interesting thing is in the particle models, it's very difficult to. At least I'm not even sure it makes sense to actually be able to measure the energy of the universe without making some assumption about time, the absolute time. It seems like you either need one or the other, right? Because you have this formula that t equals integral d lambda t as in time. Kinetic energy divided by E minus V. So, I mean, if you see, these guys are specified by the equations of motion, but it seems like you need to either say how much time has gone by, and that gives you the energy, or you need to specify how much energy there is, and that tells you how much time has gone by. So trying to find them both consistently within the theory, I think, is very difficult. So it's not really clear to me how that applies to general relativity, but if the analogy carries through, it really makes you wonder whether or not the observations we're making about a cosmological constant or not, there might be something fishy about them in the way that we define our clocks for those observations. But that's just a comment.
So suppose you define, say you have a certain energy.
Yeah.
Zero.
Yeah.
And then you look at the time elapsed between two events. And I say, oh, I have a the same system, but now I define the energy to be E1. What's the relationship between the two times you get? Is it by a constant factor or not?
It can be different, and it can depend a lot on what the sign of the energy is, right? I mean, if the energy is positive, then this thing could be a free system. But then if you take the energy to be negative, the system could be bound. So you'll get qualitatively different predictions depending on what value the energy is. So the amount of time that goes by, it's not necessarily just a factor. I mean, it's some complicated thing, right? It's subtle, I think. If you play around with the energy, what's going to happen is that these guys are going to change a little bit, and I think it's a complex thing. And it's even more complex in the case of general relativity. So I think it's worth really kind of being very careful about what we mean. Is the cosmological constant really something that we should be making observations of? But I mean, I need to think about it longer, I think. Moving on to the things that are more sure. We want to find something sort of a natural term for the kinetic energy, and what we found is that we can take this DeWitt metric, A, B, C, D. It has four indices, and what it does is it sort of feeds on rank two tensors. And the tensors we want to feed on are these symmetric guys. The derivative of the metric, the covariant derivative of the metric with this connection. And then it feeds on it twice. So so this is the analog of the square of the derivative. And just a sort of nice short way of writing this, I'm just going to write G feeding on the covariant derivative of G twice, like that, because it's a lot shorter than this. The actual formula for this guy, remember, it was, you know, we try to find the simplest thing with four indices that we can form with the metric, And then we found that there was a little bit of an ambiguity, but there was this term here, BD. And then there was some freedom in what constant we pick for the next term. But if we pick that constant to be -1, then we get sort of this DeWitt metric. So that seems like a natural choice. And it looks like GAB. GCD. Okay, so this is what we use for that guy. Now we can just write down the action that we get. And I'm going to write it out just because I want to calculate the momenta and stuff, so it'll be nice to have it on the board in all of its glory. So it's the lambda d3x, right, it's g, and then there's a g a b c d, a square root of this, and then 2 lambda minus r. So that's the action. And I told you that this is equivalent to the Beilein-Sharp Wheeler action for general relativity. And it's almost identical to it, except for this guy is replaced by the shift vector. So the interesting thing is that in the BB theory, you have this guy, a derivative, but you take the free endpoint variation. In BSW, you have the shift, which is a Lagrange multiplier. So here you have a cyclic variable, you do a free endpoint variation. Here you have a Lagrange multiplier, and you do a fixed endpoint variation. But it turns out that these two types of variation are equivalent. So that's why theories are equivalent. But the important observation is that it's a different, very different starting point. Right? Here you've got, you really consider this as a derivative, and you're taking a free endpoint variation. So so conceptually, it's a completely different starting point. I mean, the way you get BSW is you try to, you start with the ADM action, then you try to eliminate the shift from that. And you get this action. But the way that BB came up with this was just trying to find a way of defining a metric on the relational configuration space of three-dimensional geometries. So, I mean, it's a completely different starting point. So, a priori, you wouldn't expect them to lead to the same result. And that's why I think it's kind of really beautiful that you do get general relativity. But one thing that you can do with this new insight is that you can imagine taking this and doing a fixed endpoint variation instead of a free endpoint variation. And that is completely different from anything you could do here. And if you did do that, at least in the particle models, what we found is that you get the background dependent theories. So this would give you a sort of background dependent version of general relativity, which is interesting, in particular for the time. But I'll say that for the end of today. Let me just prove to you that this is actually general relativity. So let's look at the Hamiltonian. Our momenta. Well, we have two momenta. We have the guys canonically conjugate to the g's, which we call pi. They're just di L, di g dot a b. So to calculate these guys, the only dependence on the g dots are in the kinetic energy. So you get 2 lambda minus r over g of So you get a piece like this. You get a half from the fact that you're taking the square root, but then you get a factor of 2 because you have this guy squared. And then the surviving piece looks like, there's a factor of root g, and then there's a factor of, let me just write it as g a b. So you feed him one factor of this guy, and then there's two more indices left free. So that's the pies. Then we have this other momentum, which is canonically conjugate to the auxiliary fields. So I'm just going to call it PA. And you take di L by di psi dot. But you have to do, so here it's fine, you just have to do an integration by parts to get the covariant derivative.
Shouldn't it be on the numerator, the denominator, shouldn't it be just a g dot instead of a d, because the.
Here?
No. To the left, yes. Because you're doing the differential with respect to g a b dot as opposed to d psi g a b.
Yeah, but it's just the chain rule, right? Like you take the derivative of this guy, which is okay. 1 over the square root. So this is just short for this whole piece here. And then you multiply by the derivative of what's inside, which is this. Yeah. You do the same thing again, and you pick up an identical factor, because now you're looking for the dependency here. So you still have 2 lambda minus r over g of this. But now when you take the derivative of this guy, you need to use integration by parts because you have a covariant derivative here and you want to get rid of that. So you pick up a minus sign And then you pick up a covariant derivative with respect to this guy of the, oops, of the whole thing. And then, so now you can actually take the derivative of what's inside, and you get, you get the same, you get G, A, B, you get this. But you get it twice, because you, why do you get it twice? Because there's a symmetrization here. So there's really two terms. So you get a 2 that cancels the factor of a half from the fact that this thing is squared. But you also get another 2 because of the symmetry here. So you can basically do this twice. And so what you recognize is that this is just the covariant derivative of this guy here. Okay, so that's our linear constraint. So remember, in the particle models, we had these linear constraints. In this case, we have the same thing, except now it's 2 times b pi ab. And it looks like that. Now, to be perfectly rigorous, it should be this guy's symmetric in ab. So the 2 is like the same way as writing sort of pi b plus like this. And the reason why that's important is just because, just keep that in mind, because later I'm going to use that fact to simplify some of the equations. Actually, just to show that the Hamiltonian is equal to 0. Okay, so we have this. This is our linear constraint. And this thing is supposed to be equal to 0. Now, don't forget that because we're doing a free endpoint variation, we have to take this momentum. When we apply the equations of motion, one of our equations of motion is this Mach condition, the PA is equal to 0. Which would lead to this thing, which is the diff constraint, the Diffeo constraint of GR. Right? So you can see that once we apply this free endpoint variation, this constraint just turns into this, which is the standard Diffeo constraint of general relativity. All right. So we picked up the Diffeo constraint, but we still have one more constraint, and that's the Hamiltonian constraint. And that comes from the fact that you have a vector g here divided by its length, kind of. So you get, this momentum is actually a direction in the configuration space, in the same way that the momentos were directions before. And they obey this circle identity, which is that if I take the square, if I take the inverse of G, of the big G, A, B, C, D, so this is the thing that when you collapse it down with the upstairs guys, it'll give 1. So this is the inverse of G, and you take pi A, B, pi C, D, that should be equal to 2 lambda minus r. So this is the thing that looked like, remember in the particle models we had sum over I pi squared over 2mi plus v equals 0. This was our old Hamiltonian constraint. Here you can see you just took the inner product of the p's on the configuration space. So here we're just taking the inner product of the pi's in the configuration space with this guy, which is the natural thing to do. And then we multiply by that. Actually, to get this to work properly the way I defined it, you need to put a root g in here. So we can check that this is true. Okay, so, oh, sorry, this is not a root. This is just a G. So we have G, A, B, C, D. And then we have this guy squared. So 2 lambda minus R over this. And then we have sort of G, A, B, N, M times G dot N, M and then we have G, we're going to collapse this with C, D, O, P, G dot O, P plus O, P. So then you notice when you take this guy and you use him to lower the indices here, you'll get that the N, M guys should replace the C, D guys. And that will give you G, N, M, O, P times this, which is just this thing. And that is exactly the piece that we need to cancel our minus 2 lambda minus R. Because, I forgot to write that there is also two factors of minus G. So the G's cancel, and then this piece will cancel on what's left here, and we've got zero. So that's the Hamiltonian constraint. So this guy is the Hamiltonian constraint, and it's completely equivalent to it's the same as the normal Hamiltonian constraint that we use. The last thing is to compute the Hamiltonian. We know what the constraints are. It turns out these are all the constraints. So they're both first class primary constraints. And it turns out that they commute with each other, but that's just known from general relativity. So it's actually pretty long, I think, calculation to do, but they do commute. So let's write down the Hamiltonian. The reason why I'm doing this is because this part is slightly different from normal general relativity. I mean, you've got these two pieces here, or this piece rather, but now you also have a PA times psi A, which is not in the normal description. So it's, you know, good to check that this is actually going to give you zero. Although we expect that because it's a reparameterization invariant theory. So we can just plug in the equations here. The pi is, from the pi and from the p, you're going to have a root g times this factor. Okay, I take that back. Do I need to show this? Okay, why don't I just show it? It's not long. So we get minus g. This piece, we get 2 lambda minus r over g. So now it's going to be G dot. So it feeds on this and G dot. Plus, because that's the G dot that's here. So this is the, so I've just sort of inserted G dot into this blank thing here. And then now I'm going to do the same thing, but I'm going to insert, I'm going to collapse the free index here with sigma or with not seamless, whatever this guy is, psi or psi. But now I have to deal with the covariant derivatives, which is okay because what I can do is use integration by parts to move this guy off of here back onto the size. And I can use the fact that that the pi is symmetric to get that what I'm actually going to have is, this is what I'm going to have. I certainly will have this factor here. And then I'm going to have a G, G. And now the thing that I need to feed in here is going to be sort of the symmetrized version. And I got the covariant derivative by doing the integration by parts. And that gets rid of the minus sign here. And then I get the symmetrization of that by the fact that pi is symmetric and the factor of 2. Okay, so that's this piece. And minus the Lagrangian. But what you can see now is that I have a piece that feeds on the G dot and a piece that feeds on this guy. So really what I have is I have minus G. Times this guy, because this guy is this piece plus this piece. So when this guy will cancel one factor of the square root on the bottom, and you get the original Lagrangian that we had. So that is, this thing is equal to the Lagrangian, and then this is equal to 0. Okay. So the canonical Hamiltonian is 0, which means that, yeah.
How do you achieve the integration by parts?
Because, I mean, these should all be like functional. There is an integral. That's the thing. I mean,
this is the Hamiltonian.
This is the Hamiltonian. Yeah. Yeah, the Hamiltonian needs to be integrated. So there's. I'm sort of cheating when I just write the, the other condition that's very important is actually that I didn't say this, but sigma has no boundary, so that you can do all these integration by parts without picking up boundary terms. All right, so let's.
You get different physics if you have boundary terms as opposed to the normal GR.
I'm not sure. It's an interesting question. I know that all the work that's been done so far has just assumed that the boundary is closed. Nobody's considered what you get if you have an actual boundary. So it might be worth looking into. The total Hamiltonian is then going to be just the constraints. So the Lagrange multiplier times the Hamiltonian constraint plus another Lagrange multiplier, which is now a vector, times the Diffeot constraint, which I called L. I'll call it L again. And this is the ADM Hamiltonian. So this thing is called the lapse, and this is the shift. You can see that we're going to pick up a new set of equations of motion from the derivative of this guy. This plus on brackets is very easy to work out because the only thing that this won't commute with in the Hamiltonian is the p in this constraint. So this is just proportional to n. A. So, So this shift is actually the derivative of our auxiliary field. So so you have this extra condition. And once you have that extra condition, that's when these two theories become equivalent. So so that's the claim. Now, any questions about that? I mean, I know that was very dry and mathematical. Oh, I should also say that now, I mean, if we do the variation of the metric, I'm not going to do it. But what you get is the 3 plus 1 version of the Einstein equations. And this thing that I call the lapse, it winds up being related to the 0, 0 component of the metric, the 4 metric now. So this is the 4 metric. And then this guy, which is the shift, is related to the A, 0 component of the 4 metric. So so with these identifications, you recover the four-dimensional Einstein equations. And of course, the three metric, excuse me, is the three metric of here. So you've picked up all the components of the metric. Now, I wanted to make a little bit of a comment about observables, because if you, the things that we noticed were observable in the particle models. Were the sort of exponential of the auxiliary fields multiplied by the configuration space variables. So in this case, we would have the analogous thing would be the exponential of the Lie derivative. Of GAB. And what you'd have to do is you'd have to solve for the auxiliary fields by solving the diffeomorphism constraints here. And in the particle models, that was pretty easy to do. And the reason is because the thing that was the lapse, the N, dropped out of the equations. And that enabled us to not have to solve the Hamiltonian constraint and this guy, the diff constraint, at the same time. But in general relativity, because this guy is local, well, I'll show you what happens. If we try to solve this guy using the equations of motion, you get something that looks like n times GAB of this equals zero. And in the particle models, the N just dropped out of this equation. And so you could solve for this guy. But the problem now is that this guy is a function of space. So the covariant derivative of him is not equal to zero. So you pick up this extra term, and now the Hamiltonian constraint and the diff constraint becomes kind of coupled. And it becomes a lot more difficult to solve this. Basically, it's the result of this thing being local now in space rather than a global T. And it causes all kinds of problems. Well, it makes it a lot more technically difficult. And this is associated to the refoliation. I think I might have spelled that wrong, invariance. So essentially, the way I see it, this difficulty here is physically it's related to the refoliation invariance and the fact that you can refoliate any different way. And it makes it a lot more difficult in general relativity. But in principle, you could still define observables. And if you could solve these equations, you could possibly define observables in this way. Also, I think that there is probably some simple, highly symmetric situations where you could solve these easily and then construct observables. And in fact, I think that's what we actually do when we solve general relativity, when we actually use general relativity, because usually we use very symmetric solutions. So, what do I want to say next? Time is it? So I want to finish with an interesting observation, or and that's gauging time. So we did this in the particle models. Remember, we had this. We had this action of parameterized particle mechanics, where time became a dynamical variable, and then we just best matched the time. So you can do the same thing in general relativity, and what happens is you get to the ADM action, I would say, more directly. So just to recall, we had this Newtonian action that looked like dt times the kinetic energy minus the potential. And then what we did is we made this reparameterization invariant by promoting t to a dynamical variable. And we got an action for parameterized particle mechanics that looked like d lambda t over t dot minus t dot b. So that was the action. And now t is a dynamical variable. And the equations of motion, you find the equations of motion for t, and then you get something that's equivalent in Newtonian mechanics. Well, we can do the same thing, actually. And then what we looked at earlier in the course is that we said, okay, what if we do a free endpoint variation of the t's? So we allow them to be free at the endpoints, which is basically the same thing as sending t to t plus a. This is actually what we did. We said, okay, we have this time translational invariance, and we're going to best match it by introducing this auxiliary field, and then we're going to make a have free endpoints. But that's just equivalent to sort of redefining t and having a free endpoint variation for the t. So that's what we did. And what we found was that we got a theory that was equivalent to the Jacobi theory. So I'm going to propose that we try to do the same thing in GR. What did we get? Well, the action for the time-gauged Barber-Bertotti theory would look like something very similar. D lambda, and an integral over dx times this. And now we have the kinetic energy, which in GR is just this guy. So G. And now we divide by a time variable. So the difference now is that it's going to be a function of lambda, but also it should be a function of space. Okay, and then we subtract times the potential, which is it's 2 lambda minus r. And this is our action. And now what we're going to do is a free endpoint variation with respect to the q. I can either do it or just sort of demonstrate. Now, the ADM action, what?
Isn't it r minus 2 lambda?
Because there's a minus here. Did I screw it up?
I thought V was R minus 2 lambda.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I'm not even sure if that's the right sign. So, like that, right? Yeah. Okay. So this is actually the ADM action with the lapse playing the role of Q dot. So when you do the free, but you do a fixed endpoint variation of the lapse. And the lapse is a function of lambda and x. So really, I mean, you can sort of see that this thing is really going to be the same as the ADM action, because the free endpoint variation of this guy is going to be the same as the fixed endpoint variation of this guy. But so I guess I could go through it or I could not. But this is, it's kind of interesting that you take this different starting point, which is this theory, and you get right away to the ADM action almost directly. But one comment that I will make is the reason why, so Kukoc and even Dirac, they noticed that there is a similarity between this action and this action. But I think the one thing they didn't pick up on, so the idea was, oh, maybe there's this hidden time in general relativity, just like there's a hidden time here. And all we need to do to quantize gravity is find that hidden time and then write down a sort of a Schrodinger type equation for that. But the difference, and I think this is something that they didn't notice, is that the variations that you do are very different. In this theory, see, it's the fact that you're doing a free endpoint variation in general relativity. You're doing a variation with respect to this Lagrange multiplier and not this guy. So that what you get at the end of the day is a Jacobi theory that is timeless, right? So the quantization of the Jacobi theory is the time-independent Schrodinger equation. The quantization of this theory is the time-independent Wheeler-DeWitt equation. But if you were to do a fixed endpoint variation of the Q dots, so if you just did a fixed endpoint variation of the Q dots, then you get a time, something like a time-dependent theory. And so that's kind of interesting. It turns out that, so I thought of this just based on the particle models, and I tried to implement it. And then I realized that people had looked at theories. So the action that you get by doing that has been written down a long time ago, and it, like in the 90s, and it's winds up being the unimodular gravity. So, and with unimodular gravity, sure enough, people were able to show that you get a time-dependent Wheeler-DeWitt equation. But the stipulation is that you, instead of fixing the q's so that they're arbitrary functions of x, if you just specify that this thing is a constant, spatial constant, at the endpoints, then you get this time-dependent Wheeler-DeWitt equation and the unimodular theory. So I don't know if it's, I mean, I guess we're kind of out of time. I mean, I have a couple more pages where I could show more details of that, but what's that?
Can you not get anything noteworthy if you make it the variation fixed endpoint, which still will depend on x?
I don't know what you get. like I said, it's not doing it. I mean, this is a very different way of thinking about it, right? To think of this thing here as a cyclic variable rather than a Lagrange multiplier. And because the standard of the Lagrange equations are, dy L by dy X minus d by d lambda dy L by dy X dot equals 0. So if you have a Lagrange multiplier, right, there is no dependence of x dot. So for Lagrange multiplier, you just have dy L by dy X equals 0, right? Now, if you have a cyclic variable, so this is for a lambda multiplier. For a cyclic variable, you have this piece is equal to 0. So then the momenta become constants of motion, right? So in general, you just get that dy L by dy X dot equals a constant. But The free endpoint variation says that this constant is zero, right? And so that's why the free endpoint variation is of the cyclic variable is equivalent to a fixed endpoint variation of this guy. But if you sort of lift this, if you try to fix the endpoints, and now you have this guy equal to a constant, it's very different from this variation. So thinking of this as a cyclic variable gives you the freedom to impose impose this background structure that you don't have if you just think that this is a Lagrange multiplier. So that's why it could be interesting. The other thing in relation to observables, remember that our observables are meant to commute with all the constraints, right? So you can define observables as things that commute with the constraints. These observables don't commute with the Hamiltonian constraint, but that might be okay because the Hamiltonian constraint is a weird type of constraint. It generates reparametrizations. But it should certainly commute with this guy, and it does. And the reason why it does is because of there's a p here. So what will happen is the p will not commute with this part. And then the pi's will not commute with this part. And that those two contributions will cancel, just like they did in the particle models. But in general relativity, because of the way they do the variation, they have this constraint, which does not commute with this, because there's no p in it. So you wouldn't think that this is an observable. At least I don't think you would, from sort of the standard starting point of GR. Which is another reason, I think, why it's enlightening to think of this as a cyclic variable rather than a Lagrange multiplier. That's pretty much all I have to say. I mean, I have a couple pages of notes where I actually go through the details of this theory. But it's very similar to this, except instead of having this prefactor here is replaced by 1 over q naught dot, and the rest of it's the same. So, and then you have an equation of motion that says that this guy is equal to this. Do you want me to go through that? Yeah, okay. Why don't I do that? So maybe it's actually worth just writing down the constraints because you can actually see how you get a time-dependent Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And you'll recognize this, hopefully, from the particle models. Let me just erase. So this was our action. Now, if we do, I'm just going to look at the momenta. So the pi's are, again, the only dependence of g dot is in here. So when we take the derivatives, it's the di L by di G dot AB, right? Which is, you get a factor of root G, and you get this 1 over Q dot naught, and then you get G AB of blank. So it's the same, literally the same as before, but with this piece now replaced by that. And then the PA is di L by di psi dot. And now again, you get the same thing. You have to do integration by parts to get the derivatives, the covariant derivatives off of these pieces. But at the end of the day, you get a minus 2 covariant derivative of G A B over Q dot. And I think there's a factor of root G in here too. So this leads to the diff constraint, which is completely unchanged. The PA minus equals 0. So this thing is completely unchanged. The Hamiltonian constraint, though, is a little bit different. And that's because we actually have one more momentum that we have to calculate. And that's the guy that's canonically conjugate to this new time variable that we have. Just looking in here, it's very similar to what we had in the theory. So it's minus this guy squared minus this the potential. So it'll look like, just make sure I got the factors right. There's an overall minus sign, factor of root g. And then we have g times over q dot squared plus r minus 2 lambda. Okay. So this is the extra guy that we have. And so now when we're trying to find the Hamiltonian constraint, I mean, normally what we want to do is square this guy and then find, sort of subtract the potential. This is the old Hamiltonian constraint. But the problem is that now when we square this, we're going to have g squared, and we're going to have this guy on the bottom. And so we look and we see that, oh, look, that's the same piece that we had right here. Right? What am I trying to say? Is that clear? No. Okay. What I'm trying to say is that the Hamiltonian constraint looks like G, A, B, C, D times this. So it's the square of the pi's. Okay. But now what we're going to have to do, instead of just adding this piece, we have to add this guy here because, I guess I can write it out. So what we need to do is add p naught, and there's a factor of root g so I'm claiming this is the new version of the Hamiltonian constraint, and the way that you can see that is literally just by plugging stuff in. So we can check that this is true, because I'm going to have G, A, B, C, D. And then if I square this piece now, what I get is I get a factor of G, which is going to cancel. And then I get a factor of this guy squared, right? Which is ultimately going to want to be killing off this guy. And then I get a factor of this guy squared. But when I multiply it by this, it's going to give, what I'm going to be left with is just this piece. So why don't I just write it like that? G So that's what you get. This guy cancels. And so you're left with exactly this piece here once you divide by root g. Uh, And then the very last thing is to add the potential. That gives zero. So sure enough, this is true. Now, the analogous thing in the particle models was sum over I pi squared plus p naught plus v equals zero, where this guy was the thing canonically conjugate to time. Now it's this guy with a Fathi Ruji in the bottom. And when we quantize this, we put little hats, right? And p hat was minus I di by di t. So we picked up a time-dependent piece. Here, you get the same thing, except for this is spatially dependent. This is a sort of lambda and x. So it's not quite as clear-cut. But the way that you get unimodular gravity is you So this Hamiltonian constraint is slightly changed. The canonical Hamiltonian is still zero because it's so HC equals zero because it's a reparameterization of invariant theory. So the total Hamiltonian is N times this plus N times L. And this thing is completely unchanged. This thing is a little bit different. It has this new piece here. Okay. So the action, the Lagrangian, is going to be pi a b g dot a b plus p a l a plus p naught q naught dot plus minus the Hamiltonian, the total Hamiltonian. Okay. The only difference between this Hamiltonian, this action, and the action of unimodular gravity is that you have a this guy is required to be a spatial constant. So you have these Lagrange multiplier terms, I can just call them qi, and they collapse with the spatial derivatives of p naught. So that this guy is a spatial constant. And in that way, you interpret p naught as a cosmological constant, because it's constant. So when it appears in the Hamiltonian constraint here, it appears just like a cosmological constant. And so the challenge then is to try to find a way to reproduce this particular piece in the action. And I think that you can do that by requiring that, so you do a fixed endpoint variation of the Q naught, which, you know, it doesn't change the Hamiltonian at all. See, if you do a free endpoint variation, then P naught is zero. So you have P naught equals zero. That's the free endpoint condition. And then you just have general relativity again, standard general relativity, because this piece goes away and this piece goes away, and you're back to the ADM action. But if you do a fixed endpoint, then you keep these guys. And I think that if you require the initial guy to be a spatial constant and the final guy to be a spatial constant, that will impose this condition. And I'm not, I mean, I haven't done it, I haven't checked it in detail, but I'm pretty sure that's what you'll get. Because Raphael's done this, actually, so I think that's what you'll find. And then you get the unimodular theory. In which case it's known that you have a time-dependent Wheeler DeWitt, but of course it's obvious because now this guy just plays the role of divide IT. So, but like I said, the details are really the thing that makes it's a lot more complicated is that your time is this local thing in general relativity, and so you have to. It's a lot more complicated. Okay, so now I want to make just one more comment. Why do I care so much about having background structures and sort of no background structures? And I think that the reason why I'm spending all this time saying, okay, what's the difference between the free endpoint and the fixed endpoint variation? The reason I think is because, classically, it's pretty much equivalent whether or not you do. It's academic whether or not you say that the energy is fixed or the time is fixed. But quantum mechanically, it makes a huge difference because it's the difference between a time-dependent Wheeler-DeWitt and a time-independent Wheeler-DeWitt, and that really drastically changes what you can do with a theory because with a time. So with a time. Independent Wheeler DeWitt, it's just like having a time independent Schrodinger equation. And so you have energy eigenstates. How do you form a Hilbert space? Is it even possible to form a Hilbert space at that fundamental level of the theory? I don't think so. At least I don't know how to do that. I can imagine that if you have many, many particles and you have a big degeneracy of energy states, that you could get something that looks like a Hilbert space for subsystems. So if we believe that general relativity is really background independent, then we might have to abandon this notion of Hilbert space for the whole universe. Nevertheless, we still need to be able to recover a Hilbert space for subsystems because we do quantum mechanics in the laboratory and. We know that we need to have this Hilbert space structure. Now, the time-dependent Wheeler-DeWitt equation is ideal for that. Now that you have time dependence, you can construct the Hilbert space in unitary evolution. And the unimodular gravity people actually did this. And they propose this as a way to quantize, the correct way to quantize gravity. But the problems that they ran into is that they tried to use this to describe the entire universe. And when they did that, they found that there was instabilities and that the theories ran away and stuff. But I would argue that you don't want to do that. You don't want to take a theory like this and treat it as the theory of the whole universe. You just want to treat this as the theory of some subsystem. And that the theory on the whole universe should be the time-independent guy. And somehow, this guy should emerge in the correct limit. So I think one reason why it might be interesting to study the differences is because from the point of view of the action principle, it's the only difference between the two theories is how the variation is done at the endpoints. So. There might be a way to see how such a theory could, this theory could emerge from this theory somehow in some limit. So that, I mean, that that's why I think that it's important to think about these things.
Can you repeat why you thought there would only be a Hilbert space associated with the subsystem?
Because how do you define an inner product on when you're the only state if your states are energy eigenstates? Okay, you need to define an inner product somehow that's normalizable. That's the first challenge, and then the second challenge is then to figure out a way to label your states. It's not just the Hilbert space, it's also unitary evolution, right? How do you find that? how do you get a notion of probability when you only have one energy eigenstate that the system can be in, and show that this is preserved in time when you don't even have time in the equation. So
you're really aiming to get quantum mechanics with the notion of time back.
I don't see how.
So when you say we move to subsystems, you're saying, well, we do the trick where that subsystem can have a notion of time as the rest of the universe.
That's right. Basically, yeah, that's right. You can, the rest of the universe can act as some sort of external clock. And that, I think, will only be possible if you have this large number of things in the universe. So it could be that, I think what this is telling us is that if we just want to naively quantize general relativity, if that's what we believe is the correct way to find a theory of quantum gravity, that when we just apply those basic rules, I don't think that there will be a notion of a Hilbert space with unitary evolution on the level of the whole universe. So for those reasons, which are still, but then, hopefully the notion of unitary evolution and Hilbert space will emerge for subsystems. So the challenge then is to find a mechanism for that to happen. So because I think, I mean, you can still have a wave function. You could define a wave function on your absolute configuration space. And that wave function could just be defined as the path integral over that configuration space, because that object is, in principle, well-defined. You can write it down, at least formally. And in principle, it's well-defined. And it would just tell you correlations between different points on your configuration space. But then to have this notion of unitary evolution and Hilbert space and all these other things, I'd expect that you'd have to find a theory like this in some limit so that you actually have a proper notion of T in which you can have this unitary evolution. So that would have to be some sort of, so you'd have to show that this sort of higher fundamental theory somehow flows into this emergent theory, which is the theory that we use all the time. Because classically, we can actually get away with using this theory, and there's no problem, because we already always have this external notion of clock unless we do the whole universe, right? But most of our tests all of our tests of general relativity are for, you know, the Earth or the solar system or pulsars rotating about each other, right? There's always a background structure around that we can use as a clock and a rod. So because we're always using that, then we can use this guy. Now, the only situation where there is no background is when we do measurements for the cosmos, in which case we have terrible predictions for the cosmological constant, right? So I'm not sure if that's suggesting to us that maybe what we're doing when we use general relativities, we're always using some sort of background-dependent version of general relativity. And then we try to use the same tricks for the universe, and we're not 100% clear about what we're doing. Or maybe we are clear, and the cosmological constant problem is really a problem. But it's interesting to me that our techniques are failing for the universe, which is where you'd expect them to fail if you're not careful. So in any case, that's... but I think the real challenge is to find, if you do take this perspective, is to find a way to actually get the Hilbert space to emerge. I mean, that's not a trivial thing to do either. And you might have to make approximations, you might have to make assumptions.
This reminds me a lot of something that happens in the context of quantum reference frames.
Okay.
But we could
Should we just cut off? Yeah. So thanks a lot for coming to the course.